Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law on a sunny July day in 1990, President George H.W. Bush spent several minutes thanking all of the disability rights advocates for their work on the landmark legislation. Then he hit on the heart of the law.
3 weeks ago, we celebrated our nation's Independence Day. And today we're here to rejoice in and celebrate another Independence Day, one that is long overdue. And with today's signing of the landmark Americans for Disabilities Act, every man, woman, and child with a disability can now pass through once closed doors into a bright new era of equality, independence, and freedom.
Now, Congress is poised to amend the law over the objections of many of those same advocates or their successors from that day on the south lawn of the White House. The proposed change is intended to curb unscrupulous lawyers who threaten businesses with litigation. Opponents say that if the proposed change is signed into law, incentives for businesses to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act would end. Joining us now is columnist at the Pacific Standard who covers disability rights issues, David Perry. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you so much for having me on.
When did this start to become an issue?
The lawsuits themselves?
Yes.
Mean? Yeah, well, I mean, that's built in. So after the ADA was passed, there was an enormous amount of negotiation. And I've talked to a lot of the people who are actually there in those rooms about how to enforce it. And in the end, kind of two things were decided. One was that retailers asked for a highly specific technical list, exactly how high should a ramp be, exactly how wide should an aisle be. And then instead of having a regulatory agency then go to retailers and check and see if they're complying, like we have with health codes and all kinds of other things, right? You don't have to check whether your restaurant is complying with health codes,
right?
The government body. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the ADA, individuals, when they encounter an access barrier, when they encounter something non-compliant, the main mechanism for enforcement is that they file a lawsuit. And over the last 20 years or so, a few lawyers, really just a handful, and perhaps accelerating a little bit in the last 10 years, have taken advantage of this as a way to make money. And one thing I want to get off the bat right away for your listeners is that in the federal law, some states differ, but in the federal law, the disabled individual who encounters the access barrier cannot sue for damages. They can only sue for lawyer's fees and for correcting the problem.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Americans with Disability Act. There's a legislation pending. It's just passed the House. It's now sent to the Senate that would change. Well, it would ban lawsuits for damages at the federal level. Right now, as my guest, David Perry, a columnist at the Pacific Standard, just said, the federal law does not call for damages. These are things that happen at the state level. If you have a question or comment, we'd certainly like to hear from members of our audience who are disabled, who have had issues with the Americans with Disability Act, either for or against it, what works, what doesn't. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Have you sued in the state of Ohio? How did that work? Again, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu. So, David Perry, much of the focus that I've read about, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to be coming out of California. Is that accurate and why?
That is. They have some bad actor lawyers who found that they could more or less hire people, mostly in wheelchairs, to go to stores, check to see whether everything was in exact compliance, and then file a lot of lawsuits. And so California passed a notification act that someone like this, and that's really where it moved from. And there's a group of hotel lobbyists and a group of shopping center lobbyists that were driving this.
So there are unscrupulous lawyers out there. That's true of any, you know, any stripe of litigation. Why the focus on the ADA?
Well, that's a good question. you know, lawyers can be dealt with in a lot of ways. And I recommend the work of Robin Powell, who is a disabled woman and a lawyer who talked to me for my latest article on this bill. And unscrupulous lawyers can be addressed by ethics committees. They can be addressed through the bar associations. They can be addressed by judges themselves if they're acting in bad faith. I think that there's just a lot of businesses that don't want to comply with the ADA. They see it as an unnecessary cost for a small number of people, people they don't necessarily see as their core customers, although that's wrong. We have a lot of data on consumer habits of people with disabilities. And so they're looking for a way to get out of it. And they've had almost 30 years now to comply. So the disability community is not especially sympathetic to that argument.
You know, I've read about how some lawyers are exploiting people who are disabled, that they're, you said they're paying them, but they're also making promises of what will come and not necessarily following through.
Sure. Again, bad lawyers do bad things. But often what we see is from all kinds of groups who don't want to be sued for their bad actions, there's a fixation on bad lawyers. We can talk about tort reform as a way of, tort reform is an important issue in lots of contexts, but is also often a smokescreen for let's not solve the problem, let's focus on the lawyers who are suing about the problem. I'd like to solve the problem.
With enforcement at the federal, yeah, and with enforcement at federal level, though, instead taking it out of the hands of the courts and putting it into the hands of regulators.
I think that would be great. I think that really ultimately we should not. Fundamental civil rights of access to public spaces should not be dependent on an individual filing a lawsuit. It should be guaranteed at the federal level and enforced at the federal level.
Why wasn't it done that way in the first place? Was that a negotiation piece?
My understanding, I'm not. There are people who are real experts in the nitty-gritty, sort of the rooms where it happened,
yeah.
Negotiation on the ADA. My understanding is that that was something that the federal government didn't want to build a big agency. That's a cost issue. And that individual businesses thought focusing on these suits would be that would be a better mechanism. It's an okay mechanism, but it's one that then constantly is making the person whose access is being denied into the bad guy by filing a suit.
How is this measure expected to fare in the Senate?
That's a really good question. You know, we had in the lame duck session in 2016, a lot of laws get passed in that December kind of final weeks. And there was Jeff Flake was really driving a notifications bill in the Senate. And it was iffy. This disability rights have never broken down by party lines. It's one of these issues that doesn't conform to sort of standard left-right American divisions, as you opened in your segment, right? It was a Republican president who signed it into bill. When disability rights, positive ones, make it through the House and Senate, they tend to pass by overwhelming margins because disability is not a partisan issue. Almost all of us will become disabled in our lives. Every one of us, every single one of us, is at most one degree of separation away from someone who identifies as disabled. Mm-hmm. It's really, I think, too soon to tell. I do know that disability rights activists in D.C. are nervous about playing defense on this for 9 months until the session ends.
What are the topics of the lawsuits? Do they have to do with ramps? Or do they have to do with width of parking spaces? Is there any generalizations we can make about what most of these kinds of lawsuits are about?
It's about physical access, and there's lots of them of different kinds. It's about physical access more than other kinds of access needs. Although there are coming, one of the things that people are concerned about are compliance of internet sites to ADA, ADA specifications. But again, I want to say to your listeners, if you are blind, you have the same right to use the online banking website as if you are not blind. And that just should be a kind of a fundamental basic thing. So if you're a business and you're building a website, you should make your website accessible. If you're a business and you're building a store, you should make sure that people in a wheelchair can enter it, and that people in a wheelchair can enter it through not by going up a garbage ramp in the back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought that the law, the way the law was written, and again, correct me as always if I'm wrong, but was written to ease businesses into this. It was if you're going to do a renovation over a certain amount of money, then you have to comply with ADA standards and that kind of a thing. It wasn't like everybody had to upgrade immediately.
The original ADA, for sure. And there's always been an understanding that a mom-and-pop store doesn't have the same obligations as, say, a new McDonald's with a huge franchise behind it. A locally owned hotel is not the same as if they're putting in a new Marriott down the street. There's always been an understanding that it's about, you know, there's a reasonableness is a litigated word, but it's also a word that suggests that we understand that people have different resources and that we're expecting different things depending on those resources. But that as your business grows, you should also invest in making your business accessible. What happens with this new law, though, and I really want to say this, is that right now, if you open a business, if you don't build accessibility in, you can be sued immediately. So that's your incentive for building accessibility in. Under this new law, you essentially have 180 days to make progress after someone mentioned that they can't get into your bathroom. Uh-huh. They can't get up your... So what is there is no incentive other than being a good person, which I wish was enough, but there's just no incentive to front load your work, your new establishment with accessibility when you can wait half a year to do anything.
Well, all right, but what? So you wait half a year to do anything, but then you have to do something, right?
You have to do something, but the burden still gets higher. So one of the things, for example, and this gets into the weeds of the legislation, but of course it's in the weeds of the legislation that these things start to really make a difference.
Right.
If you are a person with a disability and you encounter an access barrier, under the new law, you would have to file a highly technical letter. So what that essentially means is you have to hire a lawyer to write you a letter.
Hmm.
Then you have to wait 60 days for the business to say, I've received your letter. Then you have to wait 120 days for the business to say they've made substantial progress. If they haven't made substantial progress, then you can sue. So you've hired a lawyer, but there's actually no expectation of being able to sue for legal fees half a year later. And so the net effect of this will be much less litigation around basic access, which may sound like a good thing, but in the end, it will mean less access. It will mean that people will not be able to go into public spaces with the same frequency as they do now. And even now, there's just so many access barriers.
David Peery, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for joining us.
I really appreciate you covering this issue.
David Peery is a columnist at the Pacific Standard. He covers disability rights issues. Coming up, we're going to talk more about the Americans with Disabilities Act, how it's changed over time, and more about what this proposed change means to everyday people. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. A bill that would amend the Americans with Disabilities Act passed the U.S. House with bipartisan support last week. Supporters say the proposed law is intended to curb lawsuit abuse by some unscrupulous attorneys. Republican Congressman Ken Calvert of California described the problem before the vote.
Unfortunately, my state, California, has become ground zero for abusive ADA lawsuits. I've heard many small businesses in my congressional district who have fallen victim to abusive ADA lawsuits that are not aimed at improving access to the disabled. In fact, California accounts for roughly 40% of ADA lawsuits nationwide, despite being home to just 12% of the country's disabled population.
Opponents say that the proposed changes will weaken incentives for businesses to comply with the ADA, a landmark measure signed into law 28 years ago. Joining us is Ohio State ADA coordinator and board member of the Center for Disability Empowerment, Scott Listener. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Also, OSU law professor and an expert in constitutional law and disability discrimination, Ruth Kolker. Welcome.
Thank you, Ann.
Note to our listeners, we did reach out to several members of Congress who sponsored the bill, as well as the International Council of Shopping Centers, an organization that helped lead the charge in favor of the measure. They either did not reply to our requests or said that they were unavailable. So, Ruth, just in general, I wanted to get a little bit of a bird's eye view of the ADA for a moment. How has it stood up over the past 28 years?
With a lot of variation. The ADA has three titles. Title one is the employment title, where there's the most litigation, that, you know, the standard situation where someone isn't able to retain their job or get hired because of a disability. Title two is the title that covers public entities like Ohio State University. As Scott knows, we have a lot of obligations to be accessible to our students and our faculty and things of that sort. And then Title three covers the private sector just with respect to their accessibility. So hotels, restaurants, laundromats, pharmacies, the rules there require them to be accessible. And as I know David Perry already said, but I'll emphasize it, you don't get damages under Title III. All you get is injunctive relief. They fix the problem that's been in place since at least 1990, 28 right. years ago.
28 years ago. And you don't get damages at the federal level, but it's at the state level where other laws have been enacted that permit damages.
There are some states that will permit damages in some situations, but the lion's share of the money that's transferred in these cases has been attorney's fees because typically when lawyers take these cases, they can get attorney's fees if they're what we call the prevailing party. That means they won. Mm-hmm. And if they won, they got a court to say, yeah, that ramp doesn't come close to meeting the ADA's requirements. Just get out a tape measure. You can see that. Then the lawyer is allowed to come in and say to the opposing party, which fought them the whole way, didn't just go in and fix the ramp and wasted their time with 30, 40 motions, says, you know what? We could pay for our time now. And that's the biggest transfer of money. It's not money going to the pockets of people who themselves are disabled.
How many states have laws that permit damages?
I don't know. Scott, do you know?
I'm not sure how many, but Florida and California are two that do.
And there,
that's
of course,
where
two
the majority of this is driven by.
And I'm just speculating that if Florida has maybe a higher percentage of people that qualify as disabled just because of the aging population down there, I don't know.
Yeah, well, both any state that's warm, would probably be a place that if people have a choice, they would rather live if they're using a wheelchair. Snow is obviously a real impediment to travel when you use a wheelchair. So California and Florida have disproportionately had more litigation than other states. But as many people have observed, there are exactly 12 lawyers in the United States who have brought most of these lawsuits that they're complaining about. And what often is ignored is these lawsuits are successful because these businesses are not in compliance. And I am not tremendously sympathetic to someone who knows this law has been around since 1990 and still hasn't bothered to do things like make their ramp accessible, make their parking spaces accessible. There's a big case right now against Steak and Shake, not a mom-and-pop store, that they're fighting vigorously. It has to do with their handicapped parking spaces. Scott and I could go in there and fix that in about 5 minutes, right?
True. Yeah. And so Steak and Shake, I'll pick on in particular – I'm willing to bet almost every Steak and Shake is well less than 20 years old. Those are new buildings for the most part. Those are recently striped.
They built them out of compliance.
They built them out of compliance. When state code and the ADA's standards are there, and so if you wanted to control this issue, doing better enforcement of state building codes would be a more intelligent way than restricting people's ability to complain when it isn't done.
Are state building codes supposed to be in compliance with ADA?
Pretty much every state building code incorporates the ADA by saying we adopt those standards or has equal standards.
So even though there is no regulatory arm to the ADA at the federal level, at the state level, they could be enforcing these things.
Many building inspectors don't review plans for that particular set
of
issues. It's gotten better over the years, so I'm more familiar with Ohio than I am other states. In the last 8-10 years, they've gotten much better at reviewing that aspect of building plans than they were when I first came to Ohio 18 years ago.
As far as the public entities go, Scott Listener, Ohio State, how does it stack up?
I would say we're in reasonably good shape. We've been fortunate or unfortunate, depending on your point of view, to be doing a lot of construction over the last 5 years.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say.
and that helps a lot.
Gets lots of practice.
So, you know, as a piece of context, I've been at OSU for 18 years. When I was hired, the average age of a campus building since building or a renovation that would have kicked in an upgrade in the standards was over 20 years. And 18 years ago, that was older. That average age was older than the ADA was in place. That age has dropped to more like 8 years now because we've done so much new construction on campus. So our buildings, our physical plant, I mean, it's 590 some odd buildings here in Columbus and 16,000 acres and another 600 buildings around the state. So I'm not going to say there's not any work that needs to be done or any, you know, maintenance that needs to be done, but largely we're in good shape.
As far as the private sector accessibility issue goes, it has been 28 years. That's a long time to go without making improvements. I'm thinking about these larger corporate entities. Are they just not aware of it? Because what difference would it make to them if they paint the line 6 inches over or make the ramp a little bit higher or lower one way or the other?
Right. I mean, when the statute was passed, what Congress did, I think, quite smartly is it says that if you're new construction, or you're doing a substantial upgrade, we're going to say that you have to meet the highest possible standard. You should just be accessible, and you should tell your architects that, and they should just do it. And I know in all architecture schools, they teach accessibility. Yeah. And they said for older structures, we'll just say that, you know, you should do what's readily achievable. You know, is it easy to just go in and repaint the parking lot? You should do that. But if you have to tear out the whole auditorium and repitch the whole thing to give access to the stage, we're not going to make you do that, right? So it was a compromise, right, that the disability community would prefer that everyone had to be in compliance tomorrow, but it's expensive, et cetera. And so what's happened is that some of these big companies, they make a mistake, right? They hire architects who decide that it would be prettier to have this certain facade. And there's a women's clothing store that my daughter used to enjoy when she was a teenager. And I couldn't believe it the first time I went to it. They just constructed it with all these unnecessary steps and no ramp. And they eventually sued, and now their design has changed. They just had their head in the sand. Some architects said, this is beautiful, and no one bothered to say, oh, well, what about disability access? And so it's a shame that companies don't communicate more strongly to their architects and designers. Do what you need to do to make it accessible. Retrofitting is always more expensive than doing it right to begin with. But like the Holocaust Museum had a famous architect working on it who himself was disabled, and he made huge design mistakes that made it inaccessible. And many people, of course, who visit the Holocaust Museum in D.C. are people who themselves are older and use wheelchairs. And they had to spend an enormous amount of money to retrofit it afterwards because someone made a mistake. So I don't know why people make mistakes. But the enforcement regime of the ADA Title III certainly should give them an incentive not to, but of course won't if this law goes into place.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act and how efforts are afoot to amend the law and make it illegal at the federal level to seek damages in lawsuits to enforce it. My guest, you just heard from Ruth Kolker. She's a law professor at OSU, an expert on constitutional law and disability issues at Ohio State. Also with me, Scott Listener. He is an ADA coordinator and board member of the Center for Disability Empowerment at OSU. And by the way, we did reach out to several Congress members who sponsored the bill, as well as proponents of the bill that's pending that helped lead the charge in favor of the measure. They either did not reply to our request or said that they were unavailable. So with that in mind, we would like to hear from businesses that have encountered problems with ADA or not. What's it been like to comply with this law? And also, listeners, we'd like to hear from people who are disabled and have encountered accessibility issues with different businesses and how they've gone about rectifying the problem. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Scott, listener, did you want to say something?
So I was going to follow up with something Ruth said about not knowing why people made mistakes. So when the ADA passed in 1990, they delayed enforcing the standards of accessible design, the facility side, for over a year while they did education, while they did promoting to architects, to contractors, to businesses, to chambers of commerce. In 2010, when they did some revisions of the regulations after 20 years, including an update in some of the standards for accessible design, again, there was a massive outreach campaign to businesses. There were hundreds of comments by chambers of commerce, by architects, by business owner, by hotel associations, et cetera. The claim in part of the proponent for this piece of legislation that we just need more education, that people just don't know this law exists and what it entails, is kind of hard to understand in the context of that much promulgation of the regulation, that much activity around it.
There are numerous references in literature that I've read to so-called drive-by lawsuits. We've referred to them already. Ruth Kolker, what are those and what's the objection, if any, to them that you think exists?
Well, what those lawsuits involve are lawyers who have some clients who themselves use wheelchairs, who are, of course, disabled, and they will explore places in their community or a little bit outside their community, often restaurants and the like, and they will notice that they do not have an accessible entrance. They don't have accessible restrooms. And they'll have these people go in, try to order, not being able to, and then they plunk down a lawsuit. And these lawsuits, you know, they're criticized by so-called drive-by lawsuits. But what's often people lose sight of is these lawsuits are successful because there wasn't an accessible entrance. There wasn't an accessible bathroom. And when my daughter was in high school a number of years ago, I think Scott helped her out. She had to do this project, you know, to graduate some capstone. And I said, well, why don't you go around the businesses where we lived in Upper Arlington? I bet you'll find a lot of blatant ADA violations. So she did. I just gave her a tape measure, and Scott showed her how to measure the weight of a door. And she immediately found that a lot of the favorite places we used to go for decal and light were inaccessible. She sent these businesses a letter, and not one of them responded because they weren't worried she was going to sue them. She didn't have a wheelchair. But I should have then sent her research, right, to one of these lawyers who does these lawsuits that says, find yourself someone who uses a wheelchair. This is easy pickings. This was, you know, 2009. I mean, so it's just amazing how there's so much criticism of these so-called drive-by lawsuits. You know, they could get Scott to come by and in 10 minutes. He could tell them the little things they need to do to correct their inaccessibility. And it's good business to correct your inaccessibility. When Scott and I have visitors in town to use wheelchairs, we have to think carefully about where we can take them to eat. We shouldn't have to think about that. These businesses should welcome our friends to join us for dinner there. So it's good business to be accessible. But unfortunately, not everyone sees that. And so these lawsuits become necessary. And we can call them drive-by lawsuits. Maybe we should instead call them, you know, vigorous enforcement of an important civil rights law that's been in place since 1990.
So I'm the first one to say somewhere out there are some frivolous lawsuits and some bad acting lawyers. That exists. On the other hand, we don't as quickly do this for other testers. So apartment rental testers who come in with testing for race discrimination. I don't remember ever hearing anybody refer to those as drive-by lawsuits. Testers are something that exist in the civil rights enforcement, self-enforcement end
that
of the universe.
That was the idea,
right?
By not having a regulatory arm, right, that people would,
right,
self-test.
I mean, that came from, you know, a long history of, under the Civil Rights Act, of people enforcing civil rights by complaint, as opposed to building code and plumbing code kinds of issues. And the ADA is much broader than that. But if you can't get in the door, then obviously you can't complain about the rest of it, so to speak.
Is there any – do we know how many people – how much their lost businesses there is from inaccessibility? Does anybody ever looked at that?
People have. I don't have those numbers accurate off the top of my head, but roughly 19 to 20% of the population has a disability.
Mm-hmm.
Almost every one of the people in the population that have a disability are in a family that's, what's the average size of a family these days? 2.5
mm-hmm. kids. Yeah.
Kids. And when Ruth talked about going out to dinner, it's not about my friend Bill not coming out to dinner at that restaurant. It's about eight of us not going out to dinner at that restaurant because mm-hmm. Bill is here along with six other presenters and Ruth and another host. And so it adds up to a fairly significant market share when you don't think about number of people in a wheelchair in the United States is a fairly small number proportionately. But when you add in
the people who
the
are
family
with them. Yeah.
and their associates, it's a fairly large number.
Sarah in German Village, you're on the air. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. As a small business owner in a very old building, I have only had one encounter where I knew I couldn't provide access to someone who wanted to come in. And it was really sad. But my building is an old brick building with a couple of stone steps out front. And you've made me think more about it, though I have several older folks who have trouble coming up the steps. But I hadn't thought about what my responsibility is as a small business renting or whose responsibility that actually is.
Ruth
the building
Kolker?
Owner.
Yeah. Ruth Kolker?
Yeah. German Village presents some serious issues. There are exemptions in the statute for historical landmarks, and so one would have to sort of look at the facade to see if there's some historical landmark rules that apply there. When you're renting, you typically are responsible for the interior of your structure, but not the exterior access from the sidewalk. Your landlord probably owns the steps. But it sometimes is not practicable to put in a ramp. That would depend upon the distance between the frontage and the sidewalk. And so that, you know, it can be – that's where the statute would allow people to come up with other solutions. Sometimes you have to go in a side entrance or a rear entrance. I know one of my favorite restaurants in German Village, you can gain access through the rear patio but not the front entrance. Of course, we never want people to come in through the rear of a building if they come in through the front, but the rear is better than not coming in at all. So that's something that small business owners can think about. They can look at their structure and say, could we create an accessible path of travel, not through the front door. Obviously, everyone wants to come through the front door. You want your clients coming through the front door. But so historical old structures, they still often are grandfathered in and don't have the same requirements as modern structures.
And the standards have elements for dealing with things that are just not structurally practical to do. And an entrance too close to the sidewalk, you might not be able to put in a permanent ramp
right.
without blocking the sidewalk.
You could put a ramp in, but it would be unusable. It would be so steep.
Well,
you can't.
Or it would block the sidewalk if it was a reasonable slope.
Yeah.
A number of businesses along High Street will use portable ramps and put in a doorbell that will say ring bell for service. They'll drop a ramp down for 10 minutes and mm-hmm. get somebody in and get somebody out. Again, it depends on the lay of the land, so mm-hmm. to speak, on how practical those issues are. Some businesses, again, and it depends on what your business is, might be able to provide that service by coming out of the store at some level, doing some online shopping and bringing the product out of the store to the street for somebody. It depends, again, on the kind of business that you're in.
So what the statute says, if you can't grant person full physical access, you should think of alternative ways to still deliver the service. Mm-hmm. So if my favorite bakery in German Village has a few steps that are impracticable to make accessible, they should have a way that I could still go there and get fresh donuts. Someone can offer to come out. Someone could offer to come out with a tray. Mm-hmm. It's good business to do that. And I think most bakeries would want to do that, but maybe they haven't thought about it. Mm-hmm. So it does sometimes require some creative thinking. The statute emphasizes the importance of that kind of creative thinking. And I've never heard drive-by lawsuits that have to do with those kinds of issues. That's not mm-hmm. what you usually hear the complaints about. One other little thing is a lot of store owners don't think about the weight of their front door. And that can be a barrier to access. The statute
can be a barrier to me. I mean, the stores are really heavy, but a lot of times those are a function of fire codes and things like that.
Right. And so, that's where you sometimes will see the paddle that you can press the button and open the door for you. But things like your doors, sometimes the doors just need to be adjusted. Sometimes it's an interior door that just needs to be adjusted. So those are can be very inexpensive fixes that really can make your building much more accessible.
We are talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was signed into law 28 years ago. Almost 28 years ago by then George H.W. Bush. Since then, there have been a lot of changes. But at the state level, some states allow damages in lawsuits to enforce the ADA. And there's a measure pending in Congress right now that would ban that at the federal level. If you have a question or comment, we'd like to hear from business owners. We'd like to hear from people who are disabled themselves about this experience of the ADA. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA, this hour. The United States House recently passed a bill that makes it harder for disabled people to sue for discrimination and prevent certain lawsuits against business owners. Critics say it is a threat to protections provided by the ADA. Still with us is OSU's ADA coordinator and board member of the Center for Disability Empowerment, Scott Listener, and OSU law professor and expert on constitutional law and disability discrimination, Ruth Kolker. And I want to remind our listeners, indeed, we did reach out to several Congress members who sponsored the bill, as well as the International Council of Shopping Centers, an organization that helped lead the charge in favor of the measure. They either did not reply to our requests or said that they were unavailable. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, I want to get at something that I was unclear about before, and that's the issue of standing. Why these lawyers, unscrupulous or not, engage people in wheelchairs to test these places out is because unless you are personally disabled, you don't have standing, even a parent.
Right. So to have standing, the courts are pretty strict. So you have to be a person who's personally affected. So you had to try to go to this place to begin with. And you have to say there's a likelihood of your return. So for a brief period of time, I had broken my leg and I was using a walker. And I was driving all the way to Connecticut to visit my daughter in college. I didn't usually do that, right? If I had some accessibility problems, I probably wouldn't have had standing, even though it was a real thing that happened to me, right, to sue these places, say that you have to be accessible in the future, because I wasn't likely to take that same trip and go by that same restaurant again. I didn't live in that community. Sure, I could have sued someone in Columbus, but it would be hard to sue someone someplace else. Even though when we think about the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which this is modeled on, the reason why Congress said you can't discriminate on the basis of race with respect to restaurants and hotels is so we could travel, right? That was like the whole point of that. And people with disabilities like to travel too. But you have to show that not only did you face discrimination, but you're likely to return.
Sarah in Galloway, you're on the air. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My question is for Scott. I work for a large school district who habitually has not been providing reasonable accommodations consistently. And as I am an advocate for children, it kind of puts me in a tough spot because I'm also an employee. So we have worked together with other teammates of mine to follow the chain of command to try to get these services for children, but we don't really know what else to do other than follow the chain
of
command.
Okay, so you're not talking about accessibility per se.
I am.
Okay, could you give us an example of what kind of service you're talking about?
In regards to deaf students not having interpreters.
Okay. Is that something that falls under Title III?
So as a school, it falls under Title II. And it also falls under IDEA. And
Individualized education.
Individuals with Disabilities Education Act that funds and, describes special education systems.
Okay.
And both of those would suggest, I mean, there's a lot of variables, and I'm not going to give really specific details.
You can't give advice over the air, but right, yeah.
But both of those would suggest that the student is entitled to good access to communications. It wouldn't intersect much with this particular bill that we're talking about today. It would be a different set of issues. There are whistleblower protections. There are some agencies in the area that she could talk to get some advice on different ways to explore whether or not the student's rights have been shortchanged or not.
Okay. Sarah, thanks for that call.
What I was going to say is look for the independent living center in your neighborhood. There are 12 around the state, and they would be a good source for a range of referrals about a wide range of access issues. So the Center for Disability Empowerment is one of those independent living centers.
Which is where Scott Listener is a board member.
Right.
Jerome in Marysville, you're on the air. Hi, Jerome.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that what's been important to me in the past when I've confronted these situations, like you were talking about in German Village, is how the proprietor treats you. There may be insurmountable problems, architectural design, historic landmark, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it makes a big difference if the proprietor understands and treats you with dignity. And if they do that, I find it's less likely to make me feel like a victim, mm-hmm. and more like a valued person, but there's just no solution.
Okay. Thanks, Jerome. Appreciate that. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We talked about drive-by lawsuits earlier, and you said, yeah, but they're successful, so what's the beef? There's also things called Google lawsuits where they're actually not even having people – they can see from just Google Earth whether or not things are accessible. Ruth Kolker?
I don't know. I haven't seen those lawsuits because you still would have to have standing.
Yeah.
So I know that there are the virtual equivalent to drive-by lawsuits that are about web page accessibility.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
I've not seen anyone successfully pursuing a complaint based on a Google
search.
Or even pictures that you post of your hotel or your facility online and say, look at all of our great amenities. I've never seen a complaint based only on we see pictures that they're not physically accessible.
Something I just read about yesterday, I don't know if it'll become a lawsuit. I hope it does. Someone posted a picture on my Facebook feed showing that someone was trying to rent a room in a hotel, and they have, of course, accessible rooms and inaccessible rooms. They're exactly the same except, the beds are configured a little bit differently and there'll be some handles right in the shower. They were charging about $100 more a night for the so-called accessible rooms. That would violate ADA Title III. You can't charge someone a surcharge for accessibility, but apparently some hotels are trying to do that. I hope that there's litigation about that. That's not a problem with it not being accessible. That's a problem with shifting the cost of accessibility to the person trying to reserve the room.
Like charging somebody a different rate to park in an accessible spot.
Right, which also violates the ADA. Right.
Right.
So there's what this shows us is that some corporate entities will go out of their way to not be acting with dignity and respect, like your previous caller had mentioned. And I certainly, if I was going on a website and I saw those differential charges, as someone who doesn't need an accessible room, I was certainly hesitant to rent any room from them because that would be so disrespectful to people in a community I care so deeply about.
Sean in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Sean. Hello, Sean.
Hi, sorry, I had to hit the mute button.
No problem.
I'm calling in just to voice my concern about the legislation that has recently passed the House, the ADA Education and Reform Act, mm-hmm. and I just wanted to voice my experience as someone who was born in 1991 after the ADA was passed, and majority of what Title III implemented was in place by the time I reached kindergarten. And that ubiquity is something that, quite honestly, I take for granted that everything is accessible and generally follows the standard. And if there's something that's not working right or a door open or not working right, I can just ask people and they'll get it fixed. My concern is with this legislation that guts the enforcement mechanism and basically would incentivize businesses to disregard Title III until they receive a complaint, which, without the possibility of recovering legal fees, a lot of people with disabilities may not have the resources to file a formal complaint and look up exactly what violation of Title III is in place, send out a formal notification, wait for the response, and all that. Lawsuits definitely aren't my... I've never filed a lawsuit, and I don't know anyone who has filed a lawsuit under Title III. That's definitely not our first recourse, but it definitely is what helps businesses to be incentivized to be compliant.
Knowing that that's a possibility. So you've had experiences where you've had a problem with accessibility with a business. You've told them about it, and they fixed it.
Right. And the thing about Title III lawsuits is, there's no punitive financial damages. They're only responsible for fixing the issue and covering the plaintiff's attorney's fees. Mm-hmm. So it's not additional damages beyond being compliant what they should have been from the get-go. Mm-hmm. The chairman of the House Judiciary Committee mm-hmm. Gave a story about a woman who was sued because she didn't have handicapped parking. And she was actually disabled herself, and she was sued under Title III. I don't know the specifics of the case, but that was used as a case where, look, even disabled people are being sued. And it doesn't matter if you're disabled or not. Any business owner is supposed to be compliant with the law and aware of the law. It shouldn't be up to disabled people to make business owners aware of the law when it's, as a business owner, any regulation that you are subject to, you're supposed to be aware of it. And that burden should fall on the business owner, not the disabled who are potentially being discriminated against.
Right? I mean,
his example.
Sean knows what he's talking about,
right? His example is a great one. I mean, about half a mile from where I used to live, there was a parking lot that was being restriped, and I just watched the restriping. It used to have accessible spaces, and guess what? They didn't restripe it with accessible spaces. Someone just made a mistake. I'm like, it's just so stupid. Like, why would you do that? I mean, and it was a well-used parking lot. It was often filled. It would have meant that someone with a wheelchair who needs an accessible space could now not go to the five or six stores there. I don't think anyone intentionally made that mistake. But I don't understand why these contractors just don't know what's the right thing and just do it. But with a complaint-driven system, it's probably still like that. I haven't driven by there lately, and it's a shame that we don't have better enforcement. But, 28 years after the statute was passed, there's still low-hanging fruit. There's still so many obvious violations that Scott and I just see every day. Mm-hmm. And this statute's passed, it's just going to become worse.
So I think, some of it is, I agree. I don't know why they don't know. Some of it is, I've heard businesses say, well, I've been here for 15 years and I've never seen a person with a wheelchair. And I'm like, well, they can't get in the door. That's going to be a problem. You're not going to see them here. But I do get a lot of calls, both in my role at OSU and the Center for Disability Empowerment gets a lot of calls from the community. They are the state steering committee for the regional ADA Technical Assistance Center. They've been in existence since the ADA have passed. They're a national network that does technical assistance and has a lot of resources for businesses and a lot of resources for individuals with disabilities. So we get a lot of calls from businesses. And mm-hmm. if it's a quick, you need to fix an access aisle in your parking lot, you need a curb cut here. There are a number of resources in town like the Center for Disability Empowerment that will give you some quick feedback mm-hmm. without necessarily hiring an architect and doing designs. But at times that's necessary mm-hmm. too. The ADA is unique in that it's pretty much the only civil rights code with a building code attached to it. But it doesn't, because it's there to enforce civil rights and not there to hold a ceiling up, it works a little bit different than a standard building code.
Scott Listener, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it. Scott Listener is ADA coordinator and board member at the Center for Disability Empowerment at OSU, and also Ruth Kolker, OSU law professor, specialist in constitutional law and disability discrimination. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Ann.
Thank you.
That's it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.